Welcome back to 94.7 The Pulse. This is the Tuesday front page. And as I said earlier, we're going to be talking about branding and connection to brand and potentially selling of the soul. Elise Margo is an expert in this subject with a legal background to put some clarity on what is becoming a bigger issue in our society. Elise, good morning and welcome to The Pulse.
Good morning, Rob. Happy to be here.
I really appreciate your time. This is an interesting subject, as I said off air. It's one that sort of came to my attention even before the big blow up of the Hancock Company and Australian Netball, with one of the players not prepared to wear the branding and the rest of the team supporting her, which was a really strong stance, and it probably highlighted maybe a change in the thought process of a lot of athletes who have previously just signed contracts and been led, if you like, as to by sponsors. Did you see that as a watershed moment in Australian sport?
I did. I think it had started happening a little bit before with Rugby Australia and Pride jumpers, where Christian believers did not want to wear a pride jumper, although they had no problem with others wearing it. But I think the Donna Wallum case really brought things into focus, because this was something that most of us could understand. You know, to wear a logo with the name of someone who had been very, very racist and made heartbreaking, you know, remarks that would be heartbreaking to most Aboriginal Australians. I think all Aboriginal Australians just didn't sit right. And I think the behaviour of the netball players in supporting Donna was absolutely correct.
What was interesting, and you'd know more about it, what might have happened behind closed doors, but it seemed very strange to me that there never seemed to be any compromise from the sponsor around this. And really, what was a case of just owning up to the history. And I suppose it would be easy to say, well, this was something that happened a long time ago. The current company apologises for those remarks, but we've moved on. But there was never any desire to do that at all. It was just either our way or the highway. Did that surprise you?
Oh, I think anyone who knows Gina Rinehart wouldn't be surprised. She's not a compromised kind of person. Look, I think both parties, both Netball Australia and Gina Rinehart, didn't cover themselves in glory. Firstly, if you're going to get a sponsor, and an important sponsor, it's important to talk to your players first and say, look, this is what's happening. We need the money. Let them discuss if there's any issues they have with that particular brand, and then deal with that prior to signing the deal. So, for example, in this particular case, I think they could have reached a deal where the players didn't wear Hancock logos on their jerseys or whatever they were wearing with the logo, but rather that they might have had Hancock prospecting, you know, banners around the stadium. You know, forcing someone to wear a logo of a business that you don't, whose brand is problematic for you, is not the way to go. And I think companies need to think about that before signing up to sponsorships and deal with these issues and bring the parties together.
The young player concerned was particularly brave, because she wasn't an established player in the team. Her career was very much in the infancy. So she took a risk, I suppose, to stand, because if Netball Australia had said, well, you've signed a contract, you either wear it or you don't play, it could have ended her career potentially. But she was very strong, but certainly more pleasing from where I sit was the support of her teammates, who rallied around and said, one in, all in, we're supporting our teammate. That was probably the most confronting thing for Netball Australia, that they had a real problem to deal with then.
Exactly. But I also think it was something easy, not for Donna Wallum. I think she was incredibly brave, and rightly so. I mean, it would be horrendous for an Aboriginal person to wear the name Hancock on their logo, regardless of how the company has rehabilitated itself, you know. There is a history, and it's a painful history, and 40 years might seem a long time in corporate life, but in the life of people who have experienced prejudice, in the life of people who have been dehumanized, that's not a long time. And certainly, you know, I wouldn't expect Jewish players to wear a Hitler logo, even if there was a Hitler corporate that had rehabilitated. And I'm not by any means comparing Hancock to Hitler. All I'm saying is this was a very, very, you know, he was incredibly racist. And to expect Aboriginal people to wear a logo with his name on, regardless of how the company has rehabilitated, was ridiculous and you know, blindingly insensitive by Netball Australia. And they could have helped handle this better. The players themselves, I think, did right by their team player. There was something a little bit easier to deal with. It becomes more difficult where it's like a personal issue. And what I mean by personal, I don't like this particular brand.
Moving forward, any young player, male or female, coming into even state representation as teenagers or something, their career is in front of them. It's a very difficult time for them as well. Of recent times since the netball saga, we've had the Australian cricket captain who's used his position to say that he won't do any advertising around an energy provider, and an established player in the Melbourne Football Club, a premiership player, has made a stance, at others also, about not wearing and not being involved in gambling advertising. But for being an established player, it's somewhat easier. The club would be reluctant to sever ties with an important player. But for a 17 and 18 year old young player coming into their sport of choice, they're somewhat over the barrel unless there's a change in philosophy from club management and club sponsor.
You're absolutely correct, Rob. We need to start looking at how we deal with sponsors and how clubs deal with sponsors. I'm not saying, you know, you're kind of within a rock and a hard place as a club, because you need sponsorship to survive. For those players to have opportunities, there needs to be some money, and most money is coming from sponsorship. So you do need the sponsorship. And look, if we had to go into every corporate, I don't think anyone is perfect, and we all have different viewpoints. So it's particularly difficult for a club to find a perfect sponsor that everybody would be happy with. But I think the bigger issue is making players wear the logos of the sponsors on their jumpers. And that should be a team decision, not, you know, the sponsor's decision. And so you could say, look, we will have your banners everywhere. We will put them up. We will, you know, put it on our advertising brochures. But the players themselves are people in their own right, and they are not just a billboard for advertising. And I think that's how it seemed previously, that you are, you know, we pay your salaries. I mean, not really for young club players, they're voluntary, but you know, if we pay your salary, well, you are billboard, and your body, you know, whatever clothes you will just wear. And that's very difficult, because you then become a brand yourself, and if you are the brand, surely you have a choice to decide what brand you wear. But that doesn't stop sponsors getting, you know, huge promotions around banners, brochures, and certainly there might be some players that are happy for a little bit of extra money and a percentage to go to the club to, you know, to be the brand of those sponsors.
On a legal aspect, Elise, I know that there's one AFL club at the moment who actually prominently has a gambling agency on their playing jumpers. If a young 17 or 18 year old puts themselves up into the draft situation, I'd be surprised if there wasn't some form of document that they have to sign from the AFL prior to being potentially being drafted to talk about this particular subject. But at what point in the legal world does that young player have the option to say, well, I'm available to go to any of the 18 clubs? If he's selected to the one who has the gambling notice and then says, hang on a minute, I'm not wearing that, is it too late once they've been drafted that they can make that sort of claim?
Absolutely. It's far too late, because they would have seen the contract, and the contract would be very clear. And once you sign a contract, you're bound by it. And so if you have a problem, you need to, if this is something very, very, very important to you, then what you should be doing is having a discussion way before, looking at all the clubs and saying, look, I'm not available for club A, B, C and D because of their sponsorship. I can't wear that. I can't wear those jumpers. And so, you know, it's the same as, like, are you going to work for an energy company mines coal, right? That's your decision. Once you sign up, you can't then say, well, I have a problem with the way you do business.
Yeah, what about the situation that the young player's in? If the AFL presents the pre-draft contract where there's 18 potential organisations that could select this young man, but one of them, only one of them, is crossing his moral grounds, if he says to the AFL, well, hang on, I'm happy to sign this, but I'm not going to that particular club, legally, does he have the right to do that?
You are an independent person. Legally, you can say, I'm not going to go to that club. The problem he has is how it's going to affect him in the draft.
Yeah, that's right. So it's a big risk for an 18-year-old that's got his sights set on being an AFL footballer that particular one club out of the 18 could potentially stop him from reaching his dream.
Exactly. And look, this is a big problem. It's a big problem if we take it in a wider context out of sport. It's a big problem for most people trying to get ahead in their careers. You know, if I get a job at a top law firm, that will look good on my CV, right? And that could get me further afield and it could get me, you know, up to greater heights. But then I might have to act for companies that I don't, whose mission I don't like. So it's always a problem for an employee. You know, we sometimes, if something is that important for us, sometimes we can't apply to places of work that would give us greater options. And that's a juggle. So I think it's a bigger conversation legally. You can't stop someone from making a living how they want to make a living. You can't stop clubs from deciding they want sponsorship from companies that you don't approve of. But what you can start doing is have the conversation about wearing logos. That's important because then you'll become a billboard. And have a much broader conversation about that. As far as your employment prospects, regardless, unfortunately, you don't get to dictate what companies can and cannot do before they employ you, unless you're a staff.
How would he go? I know there's a lot of media pundits over the journey have said that the AFL's draft situation, if it was challenged in the court, probably wouldn't sustain a conflict of interest or restraint of trade, I should say. Cliche. If a young fellow said, well, I want to play AFL football, but I only want to play with this particular club, many think that if that was challenged in court, the player would probably win. How do you see it legally that a young player saying, well, I'm happy to play, but I'm not playing with these five clubs because they support gambling?
Well, there are two things. I think media-wise, they do very well. Legally, I always say it depends. It depends on how the arguments are played out. You know, there's a rule of a competition. And those rules say that for fairness, the best, you know, we draft the best into the teams that have done badly. Right. This isn't just a plain with strangers trade. It's how to keep the competition working so that you don't have one club that continually does well because they keep drafting the best players. And so there's a broader context in which you look at the competition and the playing in the competition. So I really think it's not a slam dunk either way. Certainly as a young player, the last thing you want to be seen as challenging the AFL in court because future employees employees will say, well, this is a difficult person. So you are in a difficult perspective. I think the better way to go about things is to try and change the viewpoints of the clubs, of corporates, of sponsorships, of how they do it. It's a long road.
Well, it is. And the problem, of course, is that an individual who steps up to potentially start a career with strong thoughts on gambling. The problem, of course, is the AFL itself are big supporters of the gambling industry through sponsorship and allowing advertising. It's blatant and it's quite confronting. So when a young player whose morals are challenged, but his working career, his future in the sport is challenged, a very difficult situation to be in. Does the role of player managers in this case become in the full legal system, does the player manager hold the biggest key to getting the correct outcome for both parties?
A good player manager, but they are not without their bias. You know, they've got to get the best deals for their players, but they've also got to work within the system. And there's a bigger discussion, you know, at an individual level. Again, if you want to change the sponsorship, you've got to find other sponsors. So gambling is not a good thing, right? And we don't like the idea of gambling sponsoring sport, especially since they are actually encouraging people to bet on games. But that's what's happening now. So I don't think it's an individual player manager. I don't think it's an individual player. I mean, this needs to be at a much wider level. There needs to be a societal change, whether that's within the sporting industries, whether it's within the AFL itself. What should there be ethics when it comes to sponsorship, right? That's just the basic. And that requires a major shift, because at the moment you have a problem where people need money and they can get sponsorship from certain groups, and if they don't, they might not be able to afford to pay for young players coming up. So there needs to be a much broader conversation than just one player manager, one player.
Elise, are you finding in your role that let's go to a more mainstream form of employment, if you're in a particular job and your employers act in a certain way that changes the company's direction and it puts you in a compromised situation, are you seeing more cases in the legal system with staff challenging their employers about their business ethics?
Very much so. The younger generation, when I say younger generation, so I'm talking Gen Z, don't seem to have a problem with airing their views. Sometimes I would say too much.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's like, you know what, you've got to stop. This is just ridiculous. You've got to fight for what's reasonable. You can't just say, well, this is my view and everybody's got to fall for it. But there is much more strength of people believing they can say something and believing that they can dictate. And it has actually had profound effects on the publishing industry, for example, where certain books have not been published because the younger generation has kicked up a fuss. And I'm not actually very in favour of that, I must say, stopping, you know, cancelling authors because some of your employees don't like them is not the way to go. But they certainly, within the younger generation, they are speaking up, and some of them are having really profound effects. And I think sometimes it's important, but it depends on what it is. What are you fighting for?
So do you see the landscape changing greatly in the next little while, or do you think it'll just be small steps, little changes from both sides of the fence?
I think change to be meaningful needs to take time. So there will be certain companies where there will be massive changes as gut reactions to something. But I think for meaningful change, it will need to take a long time. And that's what happens, because you've got to bring people along with you. You know, in the Donna Whalum case, I don't think it was easy for her to bring people along with her initially, but what she was fighting for was just so clearly correct that was a very different discussion. But, you know, I don't want to be working for companies that sponsor certain things or that are involved in certain activities. That needs a much broader change within society. And maybe you're wrong as well. You know, I might have personal views as why I don't want to work for a company. That doesn't mean the whole society has to come along with me.
No, but you need to be legally able to operate in an environment where your ethics and your morals aren't challenged, and if that starts to affect your situation in any workplace, not just sport, it's going to be very interesting to see how it plays out. But I think we're going to see more challenges of this type, because there is a lot more of this circumstance being talked about and opened up, and I think people are more comfortable and confident to step forward and put their views forward.
Exactly. I think certainly within Gen Z, you hear a lot more, and a lot, and people being more ready to challenge.
Elise, Margot, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate you putting some clarity on the legal side and the moral side of this. It'll be interesting to see how it plays out. It might be your number might be one I keep to chat through later, because I have a funny feeling more of these are going to come to the fore, not just in the sporting world, but just in the general world, as business ethics is constantly challenged.
Fantastic, Rob. I look forward to a continuing conversation.
Excellent. Elise Margot, she is a lawyer in this